listeners, you may remember last year a real outlier of a bonus episode, namely my discussion with Kemper Donovan of the All About Agatha podcast concerning Agatha Christie's short story Star Over Bethlehem, in which the Queen of Crime transforms the charming Bethlehem Star into a flare-up of Lucifer's rage at failing to persuade Mary to kill baby Jesus. Yes, really. If by chance you did miss that episode, you'll definitely want to go back and listen, even if you're not normally a fan of classic detective fiction, because hey, this is not your usual detective fiction. Well, now I've got another one for you, another story from the same Agatha Christie collection, this story entitled The Island, which imagines Mary at the other end of her life, as an old woman and in, shall we say, surprising circumstances. This is a fun one, not only for the rich biblical, theological, and apocryphal themes, but also in that we theorize on when exactly Agatha wrote the story and why. If you were feeling the need for a little speculative Mariology in the form of fanfiction, you are absolutely going to love this episode. And now, without further ado, here it is.
Welcome to All About Agatha, the podcast dedicated to reading and ranking every single mystery novel written by the Queen of Crime, Dame Agatha Christie. I am Kemper Donovan, and on this episode, I will be discussing a new to this podcast, Agatha Christie short story. So this is a very happy day. I do just want to note really quick that I have a second leg of my book tour coming up. This would be the ongoing launch of The Busybody. I will be traveling to New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maine, Michigan, and Ohio. So if you are in any of those states or near any of those states, please do click on the link that I've provided in the show notes. It will take you directly to the events page of my author website. Those events are happening between the 9th and 20th of April. So you have a little bit of time. I just wanted to give a heads up ahead of time so you could make some plans. I would love to see as many of you in person as possible. It has really been so wonderful making connections with podcast listeners, and I want to continue doing that as much as possible. All right. I am going to be discussing The Island. And I am doing this with a co-host, someone who has guested on this podcast before. Let's just get right to my conversation with this guest co-host where all will be revealed. Reverend Dr. Sarah Hinlicky Wilson is no stranger to the All About Agatha podcast. She came on last year to discuss the short story Star Over Bethlehem, and it went so well that not only did I air that episode twice, I insisted that Sarah come back to the podcast to discuss another outlier short story of Christie's with a distinctly religious, a distinctly Christian theme. And I think Sarah really wants to come back as well.
That could be true. I may have even prompted you a little bit.
Thank you for that interjection, Sarah. That makes me feel really good. So Sarah, I will just remind you all, is uniquely qualified to discuss such matters because she is the associate pastor at Tokyo Lutheran Church in Japan. She is also the founder of Thornbush Press, which specializes in transgenre theology, memoirs of grace, doctrinal poetry, novels of mystagogical realism, and curated catechesis. I love all of those terms. She has written, edited, and contributed to numerous books of both theology and fiction, and has published hundreds of articles, including one on Miss Marple and low anthropology, which we discussed in our previous episode together, and I know many of you enjoyed, and another that she has put out since our last episode titled Agatha Christie, A Very Elusive Christian. And Sarah has just published this for a print magazine called The Mockingbird, and I am going to include a link for that article in the show notes. So if you are curious and you want to check it out, you should, because I have read this article as well, and it is excellent. And I think you're all going to get a huge kick out of it. And lots of erudition as well as kicks. Sarah also hosts three podcasts, Queen of the Sciences, Sarah Hinlicky Wilson Stories, and the Disentanglement podcast. And she writes the e-newsletter Theology and a Recipe. Sarah is very busy, listeners, and today she is busy co-hosting another episode of All About Agatha. Welcome, Sarah.
Oh, I have only fun in my life, as you can tell. But the getting to do Agatha Christie stuff and call it theology, I mean, does it get better than that? I'm not sure.
Definitely shoehorning Agatha Christie into your life in all ways possible, I can attest as well, is a way to spend many enjoyable hours. So I'm so thrilled to be doing this again with you. Seriously, thank you for coming on again.
My delight.
Well, let's just get right into this story that we're discussing today. And we're going to start, as we always do on this podcast, with some publication history. So this story is titled The Island, and it is the final short story, the sixth of six stories in the same collection that we already discussed when we did our first episode. So that collection is Star Over Bethlehem and Other Stories, which was published in 1965 and written by Agatha Christie Mallowan. And Sarah and I talked at some length about this collection when we covered the first in Titchener's short story, Star Over Bethlehem. But suffice to say, these are a half dozen religious themed stories outside the usual whodunit or thriller fare that Christie routinely, but by no means exclusively, published. And these stories were very personal to her as a practicing Christian and just as a person in the world, as evidenced by the fact that she chose to use her full name, Agatha Christie Mallowan.
Well, what I think we're going to have fun with in this one, Kemper, is because we don't know when she wrote any of the other stories, except for the fact that Star Over Bethlehem seemed to be written long before the collection was published. But as I've learned from your podcast, she was notorious about not ever putting dates in her notebooks. So it's very hard to figure out when something was drafted. So I think last time we sort of guessed that maybe she just wrote the other five stories in this collection to flesh it out, like in the mid-60s, in order to have this book available. Mm-hmm. But The Island specifically, there's some internal evidence that I'm going to propose a theory of when I think it could have been written that would be earlier than the early to mid-60s date that we have been assuming. So everybody stay on the edge of your seats for that one.
No, I mean, this is some major suspense here that we're building into the episode. And I'm joking lightly, but I'm really, really fascinated by your theory. So I can't wait till we get to that. And yeah, I mean, these stories are just such a disparate collection. Actually, the three stories that we'll have covered are not really a disparate collection because they are all squarely religious themed. But the other three stories, to round out the half dozen, are quite a mixed bag, and I'm sure we will get to them at some point on the podcast, because of course I want to cover every single word that Agatha Christie ever published. But I personally find it hard to believe that Christie just sat down and had Star Over Bethlehem, which we know she had written in the 40s, then was like, hey, I want to write a collection, so let me just write these specific five stories in quick succession and publish, you know, this book soon thereafter. It just feels like each of these stories was written perhaps in a specific time and a specific moment. And I think you have some really interesting evidence for the specific moment of The Island. So yes, more to come on that front. I should also note that this collection includes five poems in addition to the six stories. The poems are interspersed, so we generally get a poem and then a story and then a poem and a story and so on. And there are sometimes thematic resonances between the stories and the poems. For instance, the three poems surrounding Star Over Bethlehem and the Naughty Donkey, which would be the two stories that have been covered on this podcast thus far. All of those stories have to do with the birth of Jesus, hence Christmas, and they're very much Christmas themed, or at least Christmas adjacent themed, as the poems are as well. And actually, true story, but the first time Sarah was on this podcast to discuss Star Over Bethlehem with me, she was supposed to read out one of these Christmas themed poems for fun, but we got so busy talking about the Bible and low anthropology and whatnot that we completely forgot. I remember afterward, I think maybe we were emailing or something, we were like, oh no, we never read out that poem. I'm at this point determined to just do an episode entirely focused on Agatha's poems anyway. Yeah, I also know that Sarah has so much to share as to this story that we don't need to pad out our episode with a recitation of a poem. So there will be no poetry in this episode, but just stay tuned on that front when it comes to Agatha Christie and poetry, because I've never done anything about that. And I really would like to, because she did publish some poetry, not just in this collection. So if anyone out there, I will just throw this out there as an idea, if anyone has any published and potentially mystery-loving poets in their lives who they think would be a great fit for this episode. I am all ears. I don't have anyone specific in mind right now, but it is something that I do want to tackle at some point in the future. So just putting that out there. Okay, we are going to do a mystery breakdown here, as we did for Star Over Bethlehem, which was so much fun. I think this is a little bit more of a stretch to do a traditional mystery breakdown, but I think we're still going to get a lot out of it, actually, out of summarizing the story this way. So why don't you start us off, Sarah, with our victim?
Well, I mean, that's kind of the question. Who is the victim here? And for that matter, who is the detective? And as we were communicating about this beforehand, clearly Christy is writing this story in a way to kind of set the reader up the way you would do, the way she would do in a traditional whodunit. But it's not because there's no like murder or death or even potential death like there was in Star Over Bethlehem. Really, the mystery is, what is going on here? And wait, who are these people? And is this who I think it is? And where is this happening? So it's not whodunit, but more like, where are they doing it? And why are they doing it? And wait, who is it? Not whodunit so much.
It's a whodunit because you're like, I think I know who this is. But if that's the case, something weird is going on here. So it's like a who and then into the like why, when, where, how done it.
Exactly.
It's just confusing, but it's meant to be confusing. And then it is meant to be cleared up at the end, which is a pretty traditional trajectory for a mystery. It's just that we certainly don't have a murder mystery here. So, yeah, I mean, let's just go ahead and say that the reader is both the victim and the detective, which doesn't really make any sense to you right now, but have no fear. It will make sense in a little bit. And let's just talk about our suspects, so to speak here. Our first is Mary. Yes, that Mary, i.e. the mother of Jesus and the protagonist of Star Over Bethlehem. And if she's not the protagonist of this story, I'd say that she is certainly its central focus. And I think you could even make an argument that she is, in fact, the protagonist of this story. And it makes these two short stories, the first and the last in this collection, really nice bookends. And that feels very intentional on Christie's part. Mary is old in this story. And the events not only of the nativity, but of the crucifixion are way in the rearview mirror at this point. And we find her living on a remote island along with her son. And at this point, I will pass it along to you, Sarah.
Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Was we found out in Star Over Bethlehem, or if any Christian reader would know immediately that Mary's son died and then rose again and ascended into heaven. So how on earth can Mary be living with her son on a remote island so many years later? And so this is like how she's beginning to play with the reader already, making the reader the victim, as you suggested, is by wondering. But the whole mystery unfolds by your knowing as a Christian reader what is supposed to be going on, which is what makes all these little clues and mysteries so intriguing. So this son of Mary, who is this guy? I mean, he seems to be a mortal. He's flesh and blood. He does not appear to be the divine son of God, though he does get divine insights or visions. He seems to be straining after them. He will fall into trances as if he's dead, but then come back to life, quote unquote. So she's definitely playing with your expectations about what might happen to Jesus, but you know, it can't be Jesus. Jesus has to be gone by now. So we become quickly convinced that it can't be Jesus, but we have to figure out that who is this? How is Mary living with one of her sons?
And therein lies our mystery, listeners. We've already really gotten to the heart of the mystery here. And it really is a good one, especially for a Christian audience. And undoubtedly, Christy was writing for a Christian audience. I mean, I think she really was writing for herself, which is often the best way to write the best material. But she's undoubtedly, you know, thinking of a Christian audience when she wrote these stories. So I love that she's sort of drawing on that inherent cultural knowledge that readers will bring to this. And that Sarah is so perfectly poised to bring to all of us who may not be as well-versed in the Bible and just Christian traditions and culture and whatnot. So let's get into all of this as we enter the world as it appears to be. We open on an absolutely lovely scene-setting description of this as yet unnamed island. I'm just going to read out the first paragraph because I think it shows that when Agatha Christie wasn't concerned with pacing and placing different puzzle pieces and the 100 other plates that she kept spinning in the air in her mysteries, which is one of my favorite things about Christie, don't get me wrong, but when she was taking a break, taking a little bit of a busman's holiday, as she did with this book, she could sit back and indulge in a long-winded physical description just as well as the next author. And I think we can see her writerly powers at play here. So I'm just going to read out this opening paragraph now. There were hardly any trees on the island. It was arid land, an island of rock, and the goats could find little to eat. The shapes of the rocks were beautiful as they swept up from the sea, and their color changed with the changing of the light, going from rose to apricot to pale misty gray, deepening to mauve and to stern purple, and in a last fierceness to orange as the sun sank into that sea so rightly called wine dark. In the early mornings, the sky was a pale, proud blue, and seemed so high up and so far away that it filled one with awe to look up at it.
I love that passage, too.
Yeah, I
was struck exactly like you. Wow, she can do gorgeous scene setting when she wants to. She's normally so efficient and focused on her task that she doesn't, but that was beautiful and very evocative.
Indeed.
So then we go from this lovely scene setting description to starting to meet the people who live on this island. We get the impression that it is a small and rather rough place to live, despite the beauties of the sea. The people are busy and hardworking. They're humble. They're not wealthy at all. No, nobody special. And Mary clearly is an outsider or like recent arrival on the island. And she's described as still strong. We know that she's a tough lady who got through major temptation from the devil and Star Over Bethlehem and a flight into Egypt in the Naughty Donkey. So this was a long time ago when Mary was a young mother. But now we are left with no doubts that she is an old woman. And, you know, she has to work a bit more to keep up with the young women, but she's pulling her own weight. She's doing all right. She's a tough old lady. She's been through a lot. She can do some more.
So there's going to be a wedding on this small, modest island, and the children of the island are all excited, as children get about such occasions, and they're just kind of chattering about it, as children do. And one of them asks Mary if she's ever been to not just a wedding, but a wedding party with dancing and sweet things to eat and rose leaf jam and honey. And Mary says she remembers one wedding in particular where there was wine. And one of the other women says that, well, when the wine runs out, they'll have to drink water. But Mary proudly proclaims, "We did not drink water at this wedding."
Now, I love that line because that's the line that seals our certainty that this really is that Mary, not some other woman named Mary. There are a lot of women named Mary in the New Testament, but this is definitely Mary, the mother of Jesus. The mention of the upcoming wedding is not actually doesn't develop as a plot point. The reason this conversation took place is to let Mary say that line. And so I'm going to spell out here now how we know that this definitely identifies which Mary we're talking about. So this is drawing on the Gospel of John, chapter 2, very early on in the story, where there is a wedding at Cana. I think a lot of people have probably heard about the wedding at Cana. It's kind of a common phrase. And in the Gospel of John, this is the first of Jesus' signs. John tends to say sign rather than miracle when he talks about the amazing things Jesus can do. And there is no, in the Gospel of John, there's no birth story like Star Over Bethlehem dealt with very directly. Jesus appears immediately as a grown-up. But Mary, or rather Jesus' mother, she's not identified by name, the mother of Jesus does appear on a number of occasions. And this is the first one. So Mary, we'll just call her Mary because we know her name is Mary, is at this wedding in Cana. Jesus is there. So are some of his disciples. And the party's been going on for a few days. They took weddings pretty seriously. Then it would go on and on and on. And unfortunately, to the great shame and embarrassment of the probably parents of the bride or the patrons of the wedding, all the wine has been drunk, which means all the people are drunk, at which point you would give them either water and say, okay, people, time to sober up, or you'd give them the really lousy wine that probably doesn't taste very good because they're too drunk to know the difference. Anyway, Mary feels some sort of vicarious shame for these people. She wants to, you know, restore them to honor. And she knows what her boy is capable of. So she goes up to Jesus. And I'm going to read here from the King James Version, because I'm pretty sure that's the one that Agatha would have read and been using. So,
and it's so in beautiful, the King, right? Like the language
it is beautiful,
oh,
too.
So lush.
Yeah. So anyway, in the King James Version, here's what happens. Mary comes up to Jesus and says, you know, basically, can't you do something about them having run out of wine? And Jesus replies to her, sounds a bit cold, woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. Ooh, a little harsh with your mother there, Jesus. But she apparently like knows how things work with Jesus, because she takes it totally in stride, goes to the servants and says, whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. So just do what he tells you, basically. So then there's some further, you could say it's its own little detective story unfolds. Basically, the steward goes to check on these enormous jars of water that are set aside for purification rites. And he's told to take a sip of it. And he discovers it's not just wine. It is superb wine. And kind of the closing comment on the story is, most people give the good wine at the beginning and the lousy wine when everyone is drunk. But astonishingly enough, you have saved the best wine until now. And so it's, of course, restoring honor to the bridal party, but also it's obviously an allusion to Jesus himself, who is coming down so late in history. He is the best wine that has been saved for later.
Oh, that's interesting.
Okay, so that means we know for sure who Mary is, but then this still leaves wildly open the question of who is the son with her. It can't be that Jesus she is talking to at the wedding of Cana. So Agatha tells us that the other women knew that Mary had come to this island with her son from long away. And now there are two possible ways that we can solve this problem. I am going to give you one way to solve it now. We're going to find out that's not the correct answer, but we'll save what the actual solution is for a little bit longer. So the New Testament does mention that Jesus has brothers and sisters. Presumably they have Joseph as a father and Mary as a mother. Jesus has Mary as a mother and God Almighty as a father. So, you know, half siblings, something like that. And later on in his adulthood, his brothers are mentioned specifically. But there has been a very long-standing Christian tradition that Mary remained a virgin also after Jesus' birth. And so, of course, in that case, she would have no other children. Jesus would not even have half siblings. So my guess is that Agatha is coming from that world. She was what you would call an Anglo-Catholic. So she's a member of the Church of England, but the kind of Anglican she was much more like Catholic oriented in its teaching and in its liturgy. There are other kinds of Anglicans out there who are more low church, more evangelical, we might say. And so I think from other clues that I have seen in the way she writes and thinks, and just a little bit I know of her biography, that she may have been quite sympathetic to this view that Mary remained a virgin forever after Jesus' birth and therefore had no children. So that would make it even more strange and surprising that she has a son with her. And I think in that case, if you took that view, it would ratchet up the tension. I think that is what she's going for. But if you were a different kind of Christian reader, you might say, oh, this must be one of Jesus' half-siblings. That must account for why there's a son of hers there on the island with her.
Which makes it like sort of a robust red herring, you know, because she's going to make it very clear that that's not the answer. But there might be people who read this thinking, oh, I know what she's doing here. Like, you know, this is a little bit of an obscure reference, but sure, I know who this person must be. And no. It ends up being something different. So I like that. Would we call her like a high Anglican then?
Yeah,
you could say like for a high... sure that she was, or that's at least your sense based on the researches you've done into her specific.
I would guess so, based on the like her allusions to like the Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis, but probably the clearest indicator of her high Anglicanism is the fact that after her divorce, she never took communion again. And that would have been the assumed standard in the kind of high Anglican, Anglo-Catholic worlds, that after divorce, you never take communion. You are barred from it for life. And she voluntarily did that. However, as I discovered when I was writing the article you mentioned earlier, Agatha Christie, a very elusive Christian, she did want badly enough to get the blessing of church on her marriage to Max that they kind of bent the rules a bit and snuck up to the Church of Scotland and got married there properly in a church with ecclesiastical blessing. I don't know if the minister there just didn't recognize her, didn't know she was divorced, but they weren't supposed to do that either. But somehow Agatha engineered for herself an ecclesiastically blessed second marriage, but she still wouldn't take communion at that point. So
that's so fascinating. Again, check out that article. There's so much interesting stuff in there. All right. Well, we do get some partial clarity here when one of those children who are chattering about the island pipes up and says to Mary, "They say you had a son who was a great criminal and executed for his crimes. Is that true?" And Mary responds, "Those that should know said he was a criminal." And this felt to me a little bit like a callback to Star Over Bethlehem, which was concerned with the idea of Mary seeing into the future and learning that her beloved son, Jesus, was judged by others to be a criminal, and others who seemed to be very much in the know and in positions of authority and righteousness. But just as she does in that story, she reserves judgment, both of those who judge and of the man they are judging, i.e. her son. She says, "I do not know of myself what is right or wrong. I am too ignorant. My son loved people, good and bad, equally." So to me, this felt like, just as in the first story where she appeared, this is a Mary with a consistent character in this collection. She is steeped in the Christian virtues of modesty and humility. That phrase, "I am just an ignorant woman," definitely appears in Star Over Bethlehem. I remembered that. And she has not changed over all these years. Her character is steadfast and strong, despite, or perhaps because, not even really perhaps, I think definitely because of her quietness and her reserve. And I have to imagine that these were qualities that spoke to the shy, retiring Christie. And it's kind of, you know, spoiler alert if you haven't listened to our Star Over Bethlehem episode, but it's kind of the whole point of Star Over Bethlehem that she really does have such a high regard, I think, for quiet faith, for quiet, steadfast faith that does not make a show of itself. And Mary just feels like, you know, such a like the archetype of that kind of faith, both in that story and in this one as well. I don't know if you would agree with that, Sarah.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, in fact, the whole rest of the story is drawing out and demonstrating that about Mary's character. And I thought about this, I think there is a polemical character to Agatha making this argument. So at the end, I think we need to come back to this for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So now we know for sure that Jesus is definitely not the son who's there with Mary on the island, because yes, he's the so-called criminal who was executed. It's interesting. She doesn't have Mary say, but you know, "I know that he was innocent because God raised him from the dead," or whatever. Maybe that's the sort of thing you just mention casually to people you happen to be living on an island with. They'd probably think you were crazy, right? So we know it's not Jesus, but then still, who is it? What happens next is we start to get a few more glimpses of this other son. So we learn from one of these hardworking women neighbors that the locals regard Mary's son as a holy man, and he has visions and walks with God. But as she's walking away, the neighbors kind of cluck, cluck, pity, pity, and say, "Well, it's not her fault that her other son went wrong. You know, we all know sometimes even beloved children go bad, right? But now this son, the one with her, now he's the good one. He's the remarkable one." And the neighbor's comments, "There are times when he is animated by the Spirit and then prophesies in a loud voice. His feet, they say, rise off the ground. And then he lies like one dead for a while."
Interesting. So Mary comes home to their little stone cottage, and she sees this man bent over a scroll of parchment, half writing, half lost in the ardors of the Spirit. And now I'm quoting directly from the text. "The man was a man of great beauty, though no longer young. He had great delicacy of feature and the faraway eyes of a soul to whom spiritual life is as real as the life of the body. Presently, his hand slackened on the pen, and he seemed almost to pass into a trance, neither moving nor speaking, and indeed, hardly breathing." And then we get some classic depictions of domesticity in a Christie story, because this is a mother who is trying to get her vocationally focused son, whoever this man is, to eat his dinner to please her, if nothing else. And she is also wondering this whole time if she's doing a good enough job as a mother while downplaying her own gifts. And I just wanted to read a little bit from the text here as well, because this felt like a very Christie-ish section here in a story that does not feel very Christie-ish for the most part. So I just wanted to pull this one out here. Mary put the dishes on the table. "Your meal is ready, my son." As one who hears a faint sound from very far away, he shook his head impatiently. "The vision, so near," he muttered. "So near. When? Oh, when? Come, my son, eat." He waved the food away. "There is another hunger, another thirst, the food of the spirit, the thirst for righteousness. But you must eat to please me, to please your mother." Gently, she coaxed and scolded, and at last he came down from that high exultation and smiled at her with a human, half-teasing look. "Must I then eat to satisfy you?" "Yes, or else I shall be made unhappy." So he ate to please her, hardly noticing what the food was. And I think we've seen that dynamic in Christie before, of, you know, the sort of the driven artist who is tethered by someone who is devoted to that person. And it's funny because Christie obviously was an artist herself, and I think she actually even identified very strongly with, you know, the devoted artist type. I always think of Henrietta Savernick in The Hollow, but I think Christie was putting or pouring a lot of herself into that character, and the way that she was more concerned about her art than the people around her, sometimes almost to the point of sociopathy. But she also has so much respect for the people around these people, the ones who are supporting them, the salt of the earth kind of characters. And this is also who Mary is in this scenario.
I think we're also being kind of set up for maybe a mystery of a different order, which is, what is the authentic spiritual life? So, like you already mentioned, Mary's profound humility, which is clearly being really honored in this story. And at the same time, she's set in opposition to her mysterious son, who seems more obviously religious in his trances and visions and disregard for things of this earth. And, you know, at this point, we're still wondering, like, is she taking sides? Is she arguing that one is better than the other? And how will we know? And again, I think when we get to the end, we'll have some clearer indications of how she wants us to look at these two paths of spiritual life.
Absolutely. No, I mean, there's a question sort of underlying this whole story, which is, what does it mean to be a holy person? Like, what does it mean to be devoted to, you know, the Holy Spirit, or to a life that is religious or even exalted in nature? What does that look like? And I think ultimately the answer is, it can look like a lot of different things, actually, but let's not discount the less obvious ones.
Totally.
We'll get there eventually. So Mary clears away the dishes, and, you know, I don't want to rag on this holy man too much, but I also just, like, throughout this whole sequence was just wishing that maybe, you know, this quote unquote son could have cleared away his dishes before he took up his pen once more, just maybe, like, helped his mother figure out a little bit. Like, you can receive divine inspiration and clean up after yourself. You can have it all. that would be, like, his version of having it all. But anyway, I digress. So Mary cleans up, and then she goes outside and she looks out on the sea, and she wonders yet again if she's done everything she could. She says, "I am such an ignorant woman. I do not always know how to serve and minister to one who is assuredly a saint of God. I wash his linen and prepare his food and bring him fresh water and wash his feet. But more than that, I know not how to do." And I do like the fact that just by standing and looking out over the water and allowing these thoughts to run through her head before the next part of the story happens, and I think this is crucial, before the next part of the story happens and other characters get introduced here into the story, Mary does achieve a sense of peace by herself on her own. And Christie writes, "As she stood there, her anxiety passed. Serenity came back to her worn face." It's such a nice moment. It's such a quiet moment, and it's so simple, but I think it encapsulates a lot of what this story is really trying to say.
really well put. And, you know, so she has all the typical mother anxieties. Am I doing enough? Am I doing the right thing? You know, taking care of really practical needs. And, you know, those are normal mother questions. And then it's interesting that she just settles down and is like, okay, fine, serenity. So she needs it because some excitement is about to come her way. They are on an island, as the title of the story tells us. And all of a sudden, this great big fancy boat comes up to the pier. Two men come out and announce that they are searching the island because they have heard that here on this island dwells the Queen of Heaven. Now, they just go up to the first locals that they find and announce this quest. And so the locals quite naturally think, oh, well, they must be talking about a shrine dedicated to some goddess. And they say, well, I mean, we're not aware of any such thing here. But, you know, you should ask our women folk, because, you know, women are really secretive about their religious stuff, especially where goddesses are concerned. So you should ask them. I thought that was rather funny myself. So the two men progress on, corner some women folk who say, no, unfortunately, we don't have a shrine to a Queen of Heaven here, but we do have a holy man. You could try asking him. So they point the way all the way up. We've been told earlier that Mary's house is way at the end. It's a little stone cottage, quite, you know, humble, like everything else in this place. And so these two men show up, they come to the house, they find the holy man, and they announce, we are looking for the Queen of Heaven. Oh my goodness, this is not the thing to tell the holy man, who kind of goes ballistic. And he, you know, shouts at them, do not go astray after heathen goddesses, not after the Scarlet Woman of Babylon, nor after the abominations of the Phoenicians. There is only one Redeemer, and that is the living Son of God. So those with ears to hear will pick up from this freak out of the holy man that because there is an allusion here, an unmistakable allusion to the book of Revelation. That is the last book of the Christian Bible, last book of the New Testament. And please, for the love of God, folks, it doesn't have an S on the end. It's just Revelation. It's not Revelations. It is one big book of one revelation of one Jesus Christ. Okay, sorry. I had to get that out of my system. All right. I know you're going to have your own linguistic freak out later on, Kemper. So that was mine.
No,
so,
I feel you on those sorts of issues. For Sarah's sake, okay. Please. The book of Revelation.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So Revelation chapter 17 has a great deal talking about and condemning, and I'm quoting here, a woman sitting on a scarlet beast who is called Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. So if you are familiar with these excoriations of Revelation 17, you've gotten your first very clear clue about who this holy man is. But we'll save the rest for a little bit later. And of course, the Redeemer he's referring to is Jesus himself. So anyway, that basically sends the visitors scampering away. You don't want to cross a holy man who's unhappy with your quest. Mary, though, being a gracious kind of hostess, runs after them, apologizes for her son, basically saying, you know, he is so pure and so holy himself that he lives in a region far above the earth. In other words, he is not capable of social niceties because he is so fixated on the divine. But honestly, it's kind of funny. She basically endorses what he says and just says it in a slightly more polite way. So then she says to the visitors, I must tell you that you should not believe in all these Aphrodites and Astartes and whatever their heathen names are. There is only one God, our Father in heaven. So she too is basically saying, watch out for this Queen of Heaven, this goddess character. And it's interesting. She says there's only one God, which is a classic Jewish Israelite Old Testament affirmation. And then she clarifies further, our Father in heaven, which are the opening lines of the Lord's Prayer, the distinctly Christian prayer uttered by Jesus.
Interesting. Very interesting. Now, this is the point in the story where I got very excited because, of course, my biblical knowledge is next to nothing. So I had very little to latch onto here as a Christie scholar. And I got excited. I'm sure many of you will know why, because there was probably a word there that caught your ear when Sarah was reading from the text of what Mary had said to these men. She made two references to these Aphrodites and Astartes. And Aphrodite is, of course, the Greek goddess of love, Venus, if you're going to be all Roman about it. And Astarte was the name of a similar fertility goddess in the Middle East. She was known to the aforementioned Phoenicians. And the cult of Astarte was an attractive idolatrous cult in the world of the Old Testament. Earlier in her career, Agatha Christie referenced the cult of Astarte in her short story, The Idle House of Astarte, which was the second story within the Tuesday Club murders / the 13 problems, depending on which collection you're looking at. Those stories, of course, starred our beloved Miss Jane Marple. And that story in particular is a fan favorite. It was actually one of the short stories nominated for Agatha Christie's greatest short story at the All About Agatha panel at last year's Agatha Christie Festival. And it really does touch on the pagan cult of the goddess Astarte. It makes great use of the superstitious idea that such pagan gods might actually have the power to kill a person by supernatural means. So that just that little reference there made me very happy.
And I could imagine by now, with her extensive archaeological knowledge of the Middle East, an Astarte idol or goddess would have been that much more vivid and personal to her than it would have been when she was a very new writer.
Absolutely. So these two men seeking the Queen of Heaven basically ignore Mary, and then they praise her beauty, albeit in a rather backhanded compliment kind of a way. They say, although your face is old and ravaged with the lines of sorrow, yet to my mind, you have a face of great beauty. And I, in my time, was apprenticed to a great sculptor, so I know what beauty is. And a little later in the text, this man adds, beauty lies beneath the skin, in the bone. Yes, and beneath that again, in the heart. So I say that you are a beautiful woman, perhaps more beautiful now than you were as a young girl. And I mean, you know, we need more of this kind of philosophy on Instagram, let's say. Like that was a lovely passage. It felt a little bit to me like, are we supposed to maybe know who this man is? One of these two men who says that he was apprenticed to a great sculptor. It just felt like a very specific detail about him, but that certainly did not bring anyone to mind for me. I was just wondering if you felt similarly about that.
So. Yeah, I kind of wondered if it was an illusion, but if so, that's one that I don't know. that was not a biblical illusion, so I don't know what it refers to. And it might just have been an excuse for him to say, like, no, really, I know what beauty is.
Right. I know beauty. Like, you know, I'm a sculptor. And I mean, it was very Christie-esque. I mean, I actually already brought up Henrietta Savernake in The Hollow, but she is a sculptor, a sculptress, as they would have said back then. I think now we would probably just use the gender-neutral term sculptor. But she talks about that, the way the things actually look and sort of getting the bones of them. And like that, this feels like a very Christie-esque treatise on true beauty. I just really enjoyed it.
And it also gives her in the story an opportunity for Mary to protest and recall her youth. She says, well, once perhaps I was beautiful when I wove the colored tapestry in the temple, or when I poured my husband's wine in the shop and held my firstborn son in my arms. So we can, of course, we know what it meant to hold her firstborn son in her arms. Her husband, Joseph, was a carpenter, so presumably it's that. I don't know if Jesus was involved in this particular wine that she was pouring out. But the first thing she mentions, again, is probably not going to be all that obvious, even to people better acquainted with the Bible, because it's actually an allusion to an apocryphal writing. So that means the Apocrypha are writings that concern figures of the Bible, but they're basically written much later in time, or at least significantly later than things that are in the actual biblical canon. They're often not by the people that they're attributed to, and they weren't ultimately accepted as actually authentic or faithful to the source material. But anyway, you can imagine the fact that there's very little about Jesus' childhood or anyone's childhood in the Bible let's say, early pious fan fiction writers come up with stories about these missing childhoods. And so there are apocryphal stories from later centuries that Mary was raised in the Jerusalem temple from childhood, and that while she was there, she wove this, Agatha says, a colored tapestry. So maybe that, or possibly she wove the seamless garments that he's wearing when he's taken away to be crucified. So that's what she's alluding to there, which is interesting. That means that Agatha was well acquainted with these extra biblical pious tales about the Holy Family. family. Anyway, that the further seals the fact, yeah, this is definitely Mary, mother of Jesus. Still not quite clear on the mystery son. We're getting a little closer to the answer. But basically, the two seekers of the Queen of Heaven are discouraged. They get back on the boat, they sail away, and that's the end of it.
And at this point, you know, we still don't really know what the heck is happening here. So I think it's time for a Bridge O' Clues to help us figure out.
Yay.
All right. I will take the first one. Clue number one. So remember when we opened up this discussion, we talked about how Christy was indulging in a long-winded physical description of the island at the beginning of this story. And it was a beautiful descriptive passage. And yet, since this is Agatha Christie or Agatha Christie Mallowan, she couldn't resist inserting a clue into that lovely passage. What was the color of that sea that she described so beautifully? She described it specifically as wine dark. And that did stir a distant memory for me of the Odyssey from my freshman year of high school. And the deduction here is that if this island is in the midst of a wine dark sea, then it's pretty certain that this has to be an island in the Aegean Sea, which is so consistently described as wine dark in ancient / classical texts. And this is crucial information, as it turns out. So let's just keep that in mind for now and move on to our second clue in our bridge.
And I love it that she embeds it in the middle of this paragraph of beautiful description. You know, stick it in a list and no yep. one's going to know that it's crucial. Though wine dark really does pop, right?
It really does.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to suggest I take clues 2 and 3, and then you can pick up 4, which brings us back to the wine dark sea.
Sound please, good? Yes.
Okay.
Please.
All right, so clue number 2. Now we are finally ready to figure out who this mysterious son is. So back to the Gospel of John, which we've already heard from chapter 2 with the wedding at Cana. Jump forward to John 19. This is where we have Jesus nailed to the cross and dying. Folks out there may have heard of Jesus, you know, last words from the cross. There's many traditions around this. Well, one of the last words is being alluded to here by Agatha. And it's this, again, reading from the King James Version. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by whom he loved, he saith unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. Then saith he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her unto his own home. That's the whole scene right there. But it's very beautiful to me and very touching that in the Gospel of John, the narrator goes out of the way to tell us that Jesus made sure his mother was provided for after he was exiting from the scene, whether by death or ultimately by ascension into heaven. She is mentioned as being at the cross by the other evangelists, but this is the only case where we know that Jesus took care of her. And throughout the Gospel of John, we hear about this beloved disciple. It's not Peter. It's an unnamed disciple. And what's interesting is that the reason we call the Gospel of John the Gospel of John is because by tradition, this beloved disciple is named John, and he is the source of this gospel. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are very similar to each other. John is noticeably different. It's still fundamentally the same story, but kind of the order in which things are told is different. There's kind of different sets of emphases. It's clearly the same story of the same person, but there's kind of a different set of memories and concerns at work. So anyway, we have reason to think now pretty clearly that this young man who we find out is indeed named John is this person who is the beloved disciple who took Mary into his care while Jesus was on the cross. They lived together ever after, and for whom the gospel is named. So that's pretty cool. But that doesn't quite explain everything about this guy, because in the Gospel of John, this beloved disciple doesn't do weird stuff like fall into trances and appear to be dead and stop breathing for hours at a time. So we need to make a further connection to flesh out his picture. So back again to Revelation, which we can tell bears some kind of literary relationship to the Gospel of John. Traditionally, it was thought they were by maybe the same author. I think they're, and I would say scholarship generally thinks now they're probably not by the same author, but they are somehow related to each other. I like to say they're third cousins once removed. But the book of Revelation actually names its author as John. Like in the very first chapter, he says, I, John, and identifies himself that way. And what he has are remarkable visions. So here, let me just read out the verse from Revelation chapter 1. It begins, "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants the things that must soon take place, he made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw." So Agatha basically has at hand this long tradition of putting together the beloved disciple, source, author of the Gospel of John, with John, the visionary of the book of Revelation, who sees all these remarkable things. She has this great, basically adult adoption story that takes place in John 19, where Mary and John are given to each other mutually to form a new family after Jesus has to leave from ordinary earthly life. So what we're seeing here is that she's taking this tradition from biblical sources also at hand, but she's using it to put her own spin on it, very much like she did in Star Over Bethlehem. And we're going to see more of this as the story begins to wrap up.
That's so cool. And it reminded me, too, of even what she was doing in The Naughty Donkey, where she was just like, basically, like, I'm going to draw on every donkey that I possibly can.
Yeah, right.
For this donkey story. And just sort of, and it's great because even though, you know, she is putting her own spin on it, I mean, it's coming from a place of knowledge, right? Like, it's coming from a place of expertise and familiarity with these biblical texts. And she's just saying, no, like, I'm making a connection here and doing something in an educated way. And that's just so fascinating to me that she's being nimble with the Bible, similarly to how she was nimble in her detective stories. And it's not at all, I think, blasphemous. Like, it doesn't come across that way at all. And in fact, quite the opposite. It comes across as like, this is someone who is just so steeped in it and so dedicated to it that she wants to tell her own personal story drawing on these texts. So that's why she's doing her own thing. And it's really cool.
Yeah, it is. You know, that's why I was so excited when I found this collection, because, you know, everybody says Agatha was a very devout person. I'm like, okay, but like, where's the evidence? I couldn't see like in the biographies of her, and I read several, or, you know, Poirot is pious, Marple is pious, but like, there wasn't really like hard evidence. It was just a feeling. But then reading these stories, I was like, holy cow, she knows the scripture so well and understands their themes and convictions deeply enough to reconfigure them, play with them, and yet remain totally faithful to them. Like, that is someone who it really is. I mean, this is to me the smoking gun, right? This is the proof of her devotion right here in this book.
All right. So we are ready for our final clue, clue number 4, which has to do with where exactly we are. And this is going to return us to that wine dark sea, because Christie never specifies the name of this island. But is it possible to figure it out from these context clues? And the deduction is that yes, it's very possible. We already know that we're in the Aegean, and we can get much more specific than that. We are pretty unquestionably on the island of Patmos, which is a very tiny island close to Asia Minor, what is now Turkey, and where John, the author of the Book of Revelation, is said to have written this very book. Evidently, the island functioned as a penal colony or a place of banishment for troublemakers in the Roman Empire. So it's either that or just the generally hard scrabble life on a tiny island that explains the women's unceasing work and the men's fishing for sustenance. You know, the way in which this is clearly a modest sort of hardworking kind of lifestyle for the people living on this island. And I'll actually just let you take, I think, the rest of this, Sarah, because I just love for you to place these characters, you know, from these various biblical texts that you just pointed out on the island of Patmos and tell us what they're doing here.
Sure. So we do know from the book of Revelation that John ends up on Patmos for his crime of belief in Jesus. We also, basically, after the day of Pentecost in the book of Acts chapter 2, which is when the Holy Spirit comes on a whole bunch of the disciples so that they can preach and lots of visitors to Jerusalem can understand in their own language the preaching, and they believe and they get baptized. Mary is in those scenes, and then she is not mentioned like in any live action event thereafter. There's a brief allusion to her in one of Paul's letters. And then we'll find one more, we'll get to this a little bit later, one more possible allusion to her in the New Testament. But basically, whatever happens to her drops off the New Testament, never never tells us. So in that way, Agatha is basically free to say, well, if the beloved disciple, i.e. John, i.e. the visionary of Revelation, takes Mary into his care, then why not take her to Patmos with him when he goes into exile? And so basically, Agatha can just extend the logic of the story so far, I mean, the biblical story so far, for the purposes of her own story, and basically banish Mary to Patmos along with John.
Is there my sense in that, you know, doing a little bit of like the piddling online research that I was doing, is that I think when you read that passage from the book of John, it sounds like, okay, well, he is going to take Mary under his wing, so to speak, and take care of her into her old age and probably until her death, right? Like that's right. That seems to be what Jesus is saying, like, take care of my mother for the rest of her life. And I would imagine that that would be the conventional understanding, if you think that these two are going to be paired up then for thereafter, that John would be the one taking care of Mary, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Jesus just says, behold your mother, behold your son. And then from that point on, the disciple takes her into his home. You know, there could be women with property there, like Mary and Martha seem to have their own home, but probably Mary, you know, wouldn't have many housing options, let's say. But maybe once they form a new household, Jesus like gives them to each other in a kind of mutual way. So, you know, maybe early on, he was looking after her in her immediate grief, and then joy, and then shock, and then like, oh, I lost him, he came back, now I lost him again because he ascended into heaven. But you can imagine over time, especially as John is visited by the Spirit and has these visions, that the tables would turn and Mary would be the one to have to look after him. I think because Agatha places such a huge value on domesticity and household care, that I think for her, either side of this equation, taking care of the other is honorable and good. It's not exploitative. It would be in one of her detective stories, but here it seems like, depending on the other's need, you know, one can step up and be the caregiver.
So is it as audacious of a notion, though, to imagine Mary on the island of Patmos as what she did with the star over Bethlehem, as imagining that, you know, not as a sign of God, but actually as a misinterpreted sign of Satan? Like, is this as audacious of a spinning of this tale?
I don't think it's as audacious, because to make this beloved symbol of the star into an angry Lucifer going back to hell, I don't think you can get much more audacious than that. But until I read the story, I'd never heard any speculation about Mary going to Patmos with John. So that, and that might be because probably in reality, the John who had the vision on Patmos and the John who is the beloved disciple in the Gospel of John were not historically the same person, sure. But you know, tradition would sometimes pair them up with each other. But, right. So I think this is, in a way, she's writing her own apocrypha, right? Which, if, as I called before, is like pious fan fiction. So yeah. In a way, that she's doing the same thing with a kind of fidelity to the underlying intention, if, you know, no historical basis for it whatsoever.
Right. Because she's basically taking the connection between these two Johns and like dialing it up to 11, basically. Right. And just saying, exactly. Like, okay, if there we're really going to go there, let's just put Mary on Patmos and then let's imagine what that relationship would be like. And you know, like, she would be caring for him. And what would she tell her neighbors? And what would the neighbors think of him and of her? And basically doing her fan fiction. That's so fascinating. And it was very easy for me, I think, when I was reading Star Over Bethlehem, as someone with a glancing knowledge of, you know, the major stories, I knew. I was like, oh, wow. Like, that is, you know, that is not how it played out in like A Mall and the Night Visitors, Agatha. but with this one, I didn't have that context, actually. I didn't know if this was something that was a story that had been told in exactly the same way otherwise. And she was just merely kind of, I don't know, recontextualizing or something. But she really is telling a somewhat different story, or at least putting these pieces together in a unique way. That's really, yeah. Really interesting.
And listeners, believe it or not, there is yet another great big surprise awaiting what Agatha is doing with the story we haven't even gotten to yet.
Yes, indeed. We're going to get to a lot more in just a second, but I'm totally going out on a limb here and just reading wildly into things. But that's partially what I do on this podcast. So this is to be taken with a grain of salt. And it really is just sort of the speculation of one who enjoyed this story very much and who is very steeped in the life of Agatha Christie. But given that Christie was almost definitely writing this story in the late 1950s or early to mid 1960s, Sarah is going to get a lot more specific about that in just a little bit. I couldn't help drawing a parallel between Mary's familial support, her support of this John character, and Christie's support of her entire family. I mean, including her archaeologist husband, Sir Max Mallowan. And that's something that Lucy Worsley explored a bit in her recent biography of Christie. I mean, it is one of the new or new-ish pieces of information that she uncovered, you know, this idea that Agatha bankrolled many of her husband's archaeological excursions. I've talked even just recently about the fact that the proceeds of her 1953 novel, A Pocket Full of Rye, went to the British School of Archaeology. And I'm not saying that Agatha chose to not alter, but make the dynamics between this older female figure, Mary, and a younger male figure, John. I'm not saying that she did this because she was totally thinking of herself and her second husband, or, you know, herself and her grandson, or herself and her daughter, you know, but she was the breadwinner of her family. And I do just think it's an interesting parallel to draw, even if it wasn't intentional. And I'm almost sure it was not intentional, in fact, because she, Agatha Christie herself, was an extremely modest person. I don't think she would ever write this story and dare to put herself in the same position. But just picturing Agatha Christie writing this in this mid-ish to late career moment in her life, when she had really ascended and Agatha Christie Limited was coming about, and she just had this empire that she had built. It's just interesting to me that she wrote this story, you know, in which Mary is providing the sustenance for this very focused but dependent younger man. So I just wanted to point that out. I thought it was interesting.
That is really interesting. And, you know, it's such a big focus of the story that Mary is old. And again, mm-hmm. So if Agatha wrote it sometime between 1955 and 1965, that's the point at which she's going to really be starting to feel her age. Yes. And so maybe this idea of still being a caretaker, a breadwinner, and kind of looking back on your life, wondering if you made the right choices, as Mary does in the story, and deciding to accept it and be at peace with it, and maybe be ready to take on a new role. Mary does that more than Agatha does in the story.
But, yes. Yeah. Yes. All right. Yes. So now it is time. We have run through our bridge of clues. We have crossed over from the world as it appears to be into the world as it actually is. But we still have some surprises in store here. Sarah, why don't you take us into this world now that we know a little bit more about what's happening and who this John is, and we can see what happens to him by the end of the story.
And Mary, too. And it's going to turn out the world as it actually is more wondrous than the mystery that we were faced with in the first place. Indeed. So Mary comes home to check on son John, who is the adoptive son given to her, as well as the visionary. But he is in great distress. He feels empty. He feels cut off from God. He can no longer detect the joy of God's presence. This seems to happen quite a lot, that he draws nearer to God and then falls away and feels it very strongly both times. So she tries to comfort him. But John is kind of impatient, and he almost sort of snaps at her, like, you do not know, you cannot understand, you do not know what it is to be caught up in the spirit, to be exalted with the great glory of God. And this also, in fact, is drawn directly from the book of Revelation, again, chapter 1, where John, as he's introducing us to his great big vision, talks about being caught up in the spirit on the Lord's Day, which is an allusion to Sunday, i.e. the day that Jesus rose from the dead.
And if we remember, the whole point of the titular story, Star Over Bethlehem, Mary's rejoinder to John, I think, makes a lot of sense here, because this is what she says to him. That is true. That I have not felt. For me, there has been only memory. And John replies that memory is not enough. But Mary retorts fiercely, and fiercely is Christie's word. She says, it is enough for me. And we can really feel, or at least I really felt, the righteousness of what she said here. Agatha is just not keen on the bombastic and the spectacular, which is why she mistrusted that star over Bethlehem as a sign of God, and why I think it made so much sense to her to morph it into the opposite, to make it something that was coming from Lucifer. And it's humble Mother Mary who really seems to suit Christie's brand of spirituality here that she is showcasing. And in a way, it felt to me like she was doubling down on the point that she made in Star Over Bethlehem with this story, because the antagonist of Star Over Bethlehem was the devil, right? But here, I think you could really make an argument. I think it's fair to say that certainly in this scene, the antagonist is John, one of, you know, the apostles himself, writer, according to Christie in this story, of the book of John and the book of Revelation. That is a really bold move on Christie's part. And it's a nuanced move, right? Because now we're talking about shades of meaning here, because of course she's not denouncing John, far from it. And, you know, we'll get to where he ends up. He has such an important role to play. But I think she's really making a nuanced point here again about this question underlying the story of what does it mean to be holy? What does it mean to be devoted? What does it mean to lead a righteous life? And we see two sort of versions of that here. And Mary is really defending herself and I think doing an excellent job of it.
I agree. I think it's beautifully done and also just familially authentic. You know, within families, yeah, people go different ways. And she's showing that even people devoted to the same God can have different views of the pathway there. So then after this kind of put down and by John and self-defense of Mary, something surprising happens. She has this feeling suddenly pop up inside of her. As Agatha puts it, a strange expectancy rising in her, a fluttering, hopeful joy. And she has this urge to rush down to the shore, but she knows that John is just about to need her because sure enough, he falls into a trance. And we get probably the most disturbing description of this trance here. He began to shake all over and his body jerked, and at last his limbs stiffened, and he fell to the ground and lay like one dead. Then she covered him over for warmth and placed a fold of the cloak between his lips in case the convulsions should come back. But he lay there motionless, and there was no sign even that he breathed. Now, he's not dead. He's just in a trance. But she also clearly has experience of this, as in the convulsions should come back. So she decides, well, he'll be knocked out for a few hours. I have time to go for my walk and basically pursue this fluttering, hopeful joy that she's felt. And as she walks down to the shore, she enjoys her memories. And she's just defended her right to take her spiritual joy from memory. So she remembers a hurried flight into Egypt, which, of course, is the topic of the naughty donkey. She has a memory of the carpenter. Carpenter's shop. Again, her husband Joseph was a carpenter, and of course, of a marriage in Cana, which we've already heard about. And then she thinks to herself, perhaps at last the time has come. Now, this is very intriguing. We have had no whisper of her expecting something very specific, but it's clear from this line, she has been thinking something would happen and it hasn't happened yet. And now she thinks it might. So this again arouses our curiosity, like, oh, what's going on here? So Mary walks down to the sea. The moon is rising. It's creating kind of a pathway across the waters. And now she sees another boat coming on the shore. She would think at first, of course, it's the strangers in their handsome carved boat. But no, it is a rough fishing boat, the kind of boat that had been familiar to her all her life. And so interestingly, once again, the contrast between the fancy and the beautiful and the prestigious and the rough and humble. And it's the rough and humble one that fills her with joy. And we get another line that leads us into the same set of expectations. Now she knows it's his boat and he had come for her at last. Ooh, whose boat and who is he?
Who could this be? So Mary runs out to meet this new mystery man, slipping and stumbling over the rough stones of the beach, half sobbing and half panting, quoting there from the text. And she sees one of the three men in this boat step out and walk along the moonlit path, implicitly walk on the sea to meet her. The boat has not actually docked. Walking on water. I wonder who this could be. Mary throws herself into her son Jesus' arms. I just spoiled everything there. And tells him how she has tried to look after John just as he asked her, despite her inability to understand his spiritual ways. Again, I think it just shows how she's playing around with that. Like, who's taking care of whom here? That's just such a Christie sort of a preoccupation in her relationships. You know, some of her best character-based solutions to her puzzles have had to do with a misapprehension as to who the strong person is versus the weak, right?
Ooh,
like,
yes.
In good and bad ways, like, it can be who is the predator and who is the prey, but it could also be who is the person who is actually the rock in this relationship. And the one who the other spouse is depending upon, it's not what you thought it was. It's actually completely reversed. And that, of course, then has reverberations as to who done it. But here, I think she really is doing something a little similar. And Mary says to Jesus, I have been his mother and he has been my son. And she's really just sort of pleading with him. I hope I have been good enough for you.
I think this is the punctuation here. I know you really dig into the weeds on this show. And like, this is it. We're going to actually have to talk about the punctuation, but that sentence, please. I have been his mother and he has been my son, is followed by a dot 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 question mark, which is very evocative because it's alluding back to Jesus saying from the cross, woman, behold your son, son, behold your mother. And that was Jesus' command. And now she's saying back to him, I have been his mother, he has been my son. But then there's clearly at the end, the way she says it, there's this big question. I think, I hope, did I do a good job? Did we succeed? She really does not know.
Oh, that's so interesting. You could almost imagine Agatha Christie as someone who's read these texts so much, who's so familiar with her New Testament, reading those words from Jesus in the book of John and thinking to herself, well, what does that mean? What does that mean for her to be a mother and for him to be a son? You know, how would that actually play out? If they're living together, and complicating that very human relationship. And then Mary's sort of doubts as to, well, is this what you meant? because you can take, you can interpret those words in so many different ways. So yeah, that's really interesting. And so Jesus says to Mary, you have done all I asked you. Now you are coming home with me. How? She wants to know. And he says, we will walk together on the water. Just in case you weren't sure, people are walking on water here. And then she then realizes who the other two men in the boat are. And these are men named Simon and Andrew. And Sarah, could you tell us who these men are? Because I had no clue. And I was like, who's Simon and Andrew? I've never heard those names before in my life.
Well, Simon is the original given name of the disciple, better known as Peter. Actually, Peter is a nickname. Well, it's the Greek nickname. It's a translation of the Aramaic Cephas. Both words mean rock. You may have heard that Peter is called the rock on which Jesus would build his church. So it makes sense here that in this context, he would say Simon, his original given humble name, not his like more famous, number one apostle disciple name. And we know that Peter / Simon had a brother and the brother's name was Andrew. And I think it's really tender that she makes a point of saying, Simon and Andrew wanted to come with me to come pick you up. Like, it's so cute. Like, it's they must really have known her, right? She probably fed them on more than one occasion. And they're like, ooh, Jesus, please, can we go with you when you go to get your mom? I like that. Also, Peter famously tried to walk on water. When the time in the story when we see Jesus walking on the water, Peter says, call to me and I'll walk out to you. And so he leaps out, he starts walking on water, then he looks down and basically has a huge panic attack and starts to sink. And Jesus has to rush and grab him before he drowns. And so there's also a kind of implied contrast here that Mary, arm in arm with Jesus, can just glide across the water to the boat, no problem. And Simon Peter is probably looking on and saying, yeah, she does better than I did.
To be clear, that's not happening in this story, but that's another
illusion.
Went completely over my head. I didn't even know that. So walk on water fail for Simon / Peter. Walk on water success for Mary, linking arms, of course, with.
Yeah. And it's very interesting, like in the context of that story, I'm just thinking of this out loud now, that for Peter, it's when he takes his eyes off of Jesus that he starts to sink, you can understand the spiritual point there. Mm-hmm. And Mary, like, clearly she doesn't even notice walking on water. It's not like, ooh, cool, I get to walk on water now. Like, she's just so thrilled to be with Jesus. That's all that matters. And in the light of that, there's no way she can sink. You know, she's good. She's got her eyes on Jesus. No problem.
Absolutely.
All right. So now we're finally coming back to this weird episode of the strangers looking for the Queen of Heaven. So as they're walking out to the boat, Mary is just filling him in on all the news that he's missed and reminding him of past events. Do you remember the wedding at Cana? and how you were so rude to me. No, I'm just adding that part. But you change the water into wine. And then all of a sudden she says, oh, and today the weirdest thing happened. These strangers came looking for the Queen of Heaven. How ridiculous it was. Because, of course, like, who would go to tiny little penal colony island Patmos looking for the Queen of Heaven? But then her son says, no, they were right to seek her there. And he says, the Queen of Heaven was here on the island, but they did not know her when they saw her. And we have this lovely moment of him looking at her worn, ravaged, beautiful face and repeats the point again. The Queen of Heaven was here, but they did not know her. And then, of course, we get the point. Oh, I mean, if you didn't already sort of infer it, that Mary herself must be the Queen of Heaven. And, you know, the strangers were able to recognize her beauty. But once again, as Jesus is looking at her and affirming that she's the Queen of Heaven, you know, the first two words are worn and ravaged. This is an elderly woman who's been through a lot, has faced a lot of sorrow. And that does not disqualify her. It more than qualifies her. But there is even more going on. So this is another, we're going to have to dig down really deep to get the full story on this Queen of Heaven business. Kemper, are you ready?
I'm ready. Oh, I'm ready.
Okay. So we have here yet another reference to the book of Revelation. This time it is chapter 12. A while back, I mentioned that there's one other possible reference to Mary in the New Testament. Well, here it is. So chapter 12 begins like this. And a great sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. The passage develops from there with more about this woman, her adventures, a dragon comes after her, tries to eat the child, the earth opens up and lets forth water that drowns the dragon. It's very apocalyptic, very wild. The woman is never strictly identified as Mary. It's easy to imagine it alluding to her. This woman could also sort of figure other things. Like, she might be representative of all of Israel and like the 12 stars around her head or like the 12 tribes. But in that kind of visionary literature, you should think more in terms of overlapping meanings instead of one like strict allegorical one-to-one correspondence sort of thing. But for the purpose, especially of this story, it's not just the common use of Revelation 12 to refer to Mary, but specifically it's that this woman is wearing a crown of stars. And who wears crowns? Royalty, like kings and queens. And so this passage, specifically the use of the woman as Mary and then the crown of stars, has been a source in the Christian tradition for hundreds of years for talking about Mary as the Queen of Heaven. Ta-da! Queen, like as in the queen mom, because obviously her son is the true king, so she is not a consort of Jesus, who is the true king, but his mother. That kind of Queen of Heaven.
It wasn't actually super obvious to me immediately when these two men came and said, you know, we're searching for the Queen of Heaven. I mean, of course I knew where the story was going. And that's what's also so lovely about all these stories. Same goes for Star Over Bethlehem. Yes, there's intrigue and mystery at the center of these, but we know as even just semi-astute readers where these things are trending. But I think when you can draw on this knowledge that you're drawing on here and sharing with all of us in this episode, which is why I'm so glad you're here, Sarah, it just enriches the experience of reading this story. And I will pay you the ultimate compliment. And I was thinking this as I was just sitting here listening to you. And it's that sometimes I try to imagine what Agatha Christie would make of, you know, the All About Agatha podcast and just all of the scholarship surrounding her. And I think she would be so supremely weirded out by all of it and just be like, like weirded out not only by its content, which she would never listen to. She'd be like, no. She'd listen to like 1 minute and then be like, nope, I'm going to stop that. Weirded out by its content, but also just like by how much time and effort people like me put into this. But I would bet you that these episodes about these stories she would relish, because I think she had the same delight in these specific texts. And like, she was being a scholar, like she was actually engaging in the sort of like scholarly analysis that we're doing here. So I have a feeling she'd be like, yes, this is something like, you got it. And it would just be really pleasing to her. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, that's fun. You know, I don't know if she was into theological debates. Maybe we'd have some lively discussions. I certainly do not come from from a tradition with this kind of very high veneration of Mary. Like, the Queen of Heaven is not part of my tradition at all. But maybe that's actually where we can get into my hypothesis about when this story was written, because I had to embellish my Lutheran understanding here a bit more about Catholic, Roman Catholic, and Anglo-Catholic Marian traditions. And so here's what I found out. And I think this really makes a lot of sense. So again, Mary as Queen of Heaven, or especially high veneration of Mary as the mother of Jesus, is very old, and it would have been present in the Anglican as well as in the Roman Catholic traditions. But in the mid-20th century, there were some developments that I think had to have been on Agatha's mind, and maybe even are the inspiration for this story. So in the year 1950, Pope Pius XII actually declared infallibly a new dogma, of course, not new out of nowhere. It had been a pious opinion for a long time, a strong tradition of the Assumption of Mary, which means Mary did not die like people normally die, but she was taken directly into heaven. I just feel the need to say there is no strict biblical basis for this. It is a long tradition. We do have like two Old Testament figures who don't die but go directly to heaven. So it's drawing on that possibility and some other inferences and pious developments within the Catholic Church. Anyway, so this was promulgated as binding dogma on the Catholic faithful in 1950. And it is connected in terms of the development of Catholic doctrine to the 1854 declaration of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception of Mary, which means that Mary herself was conceived without original sin. The idea is that it made her a proper vessel to nurture the fetal Jesus in her womb. And I just need to say, people often think the Immaculate Conception refers to Jesus. It doesn't, because of course he's immaculate. Like, you don't have to say that's just obvious. So the new dogma is from 1854 is the Immaculate Conception of Mary.
And I just have to insert an aside here, because I actually, believe it or not, have something to add when it comes to the Immaculate Conception of Mary. I don't know if this has ever come up on the podcast before. Perhaps it had at some point during a discussion with my former partner, Catherine Brobeck, because I know that she would appreciate this. I did an internship just after my freshman year of college. So a long, long time ago, at the Cloisters in New York City. So that is a medieval art and architecture museum. It is an arm of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's this lovely little museum all the way up in the northernmost part of Manhattan. And so far north of Manhattan, like, so many people would come to the museum and be like, I cannot believe I'm still in Manhattan. Because like, you're basically like surrounded by the Bronx. It's called Inwood, and it really is crazily north, but you are still on the island of Manhattan. You do not have to pass over water to get there, but you do have to take a very long subway. And it's just lovely because the museum actually has architecture that is woven into the masonry of the museum itself, so that you're like able to like go into like the nave of a church that was disassembled and then reassembled brick by brick from Spain, for example. And it's just gorgeous. And then they have lots of different pieces within the museum. And part of my internship involved giving regular tours to camp groups, to groups of kids. But the entire internship, I did a sort of course of independent research into certain pieces in the museum that interested me. And at the end of the summer, I gave an adult tour, and I did it a couple of times. And one of the pieces, I mean, there are so many depictions of Jesus's birth and of Mary and baby Jesus, of course, but there actually was one depiction of Mary's birth. And I always had to specify in the tour when I was standing in front of this, that this was the actual Immaculate Conception. And the way I said it was, you know, this is the Immaculate Conception. Jesus' birth was the miracle birth. It really wasn't a conception, so to speak. I mean, obviously we can get into the technicalities of that, but I could always see it in the eyes of the people that I was speaking to, that they just didn't believe me. And a few of them would even talk back and say, and these were all people who, you know, were devout Christians and practicing for years, some of them decades. And they'd be like, no, you're wrong. And I was 19 at the time, and I think they just thought that I was a misinformed youngster. And it was so frustrating because I think there's this real sense of like, no, the Immaculate Conception has to do with the conception, quote unquote, of Jesus, and it really doesn't. So I love that I'm able to air this fact and just sort of put that out there. And I'm not surprised that you were the means by which I was able to do that, Sarah. And I'm thrilled that something that you said, I actually knew beforehand for once.
Well, I just have to say, I'm super jealous of an internship at the Cloisters. That is a gorgeous little spot. That must have been very cool. Great way to spend a summer.
It's like one of the cool, it is definitely the coolest summer job that I ever had. I remember I was like, well, I just peaked early. Like that's, I'm never really going to be able to best that. But yeah, it was fantastic.
Well, a come down to being host of All About Agatha isn't too bad. So this is happening in 1950, this Assumption of Mary. And so I'm sure it was very much in the air, very much in dispute. So, of course, Agatha is an Anglican and it's not binding on her conscience, but I'm sure there was a lot of talk about it. I would say within the broad Anglican family, there probably were some people, and I would guess she counts among them, who were fairly friendly to this. And there are probably others who were radically opposed to it. So it was probably a dispute within the Church of England as well. And other Protestants and Orthodox have, some of them have held to these opinions about Mary without making them binding dogma on the conscience. So I'm guessing that was kind of in the air in the conversation among the faithful. But that's not all. 4 years later, in 1954, Pope Pius XII issued an encyclical that's kind of like a circular letter of teaching that goes out to the whole Catholic Church on earth. And it's called Ad Caeli Regina, which means, get it? Are you ready for it? To the Queen of Heaven.
What?
And this, I know, right? This encyclical established a feast day on the church calendar of the Queenship of Mary. And it falls on August 22nd, which is a week after the Assumption of Mary on August 15th. So very much tying together Mary's non-death direct assumption into heaven with her being the Queen of Heaven. And lo and behold, what do we have here in this story? But Mary being recognized as Queen of Heaven above all by Jesus, but the Jesus who comes back for her and takes her away on the boat, and we can assume they are not crossing over to Asia Minor to hang out there with the Roman Empire. They are going on this boat somehow or other directly to heaven. Mary is not going to die. She's going to be assumed directly into heaven. So we don't know, as we said at the beginning, when exactly Agatha wrote these stories, but it seems to me with these two things, the Assumption of Mary dogma and then the encyclical on Mary as the Queen of Heaven and an actual feast day being established, I would bet that these stories were written maybe in the mid to late 50s when this conversation is the air and it kind of gets her juices bubbling and thinking, ooh, I can recast some of these Mary and John traditions in order to explore what exactly it means to be assumed into heaven and also what exactly it means to be queen. And there, I think we're, as we wrap up, we'll come to the ever so slightly polemical nature of her argument about Mary as Queen of Heaven.
Yes, so she's really engaging a little bit of Mariology, right, of her own, which is
definitely so
interesting. And I love that you're able to place that. And of course, I mean, it could have been a little later, obviously, but I think that is so often what happened with Christy, where I like how you say it got her juices flowing, because I totally buy that. You know, I buy that these things were in the air, and we know that she latched on very often to events in the real world. Sometimes it was true crime scenarios, but other times I think it could be something like this. And she read the newspaper, you know, she thought very deeply about these sorts of issues, and I think talked a lot about them with the people who she was close to. So I completely buy this, and I love that we're able to, I think, anchor the story in the events of her life or events that were going on around her at a specific point in her life. We return at the end of this story to John, because it really does feel like Mary is gone, right? I mean, like she's out. I mean, this is an exit that also made me think of the way that the mysterious Harley Quinn exits the scene in The Man from the Sea, right? She's not coming back.
No.
And he does wake up from his trance. Remember, he seems as though he is dead in these trances, but he always does wake up. And Mary did what she could to make him comfortable. And she knew he would wake up, and he did. And he wakes up on the Lord's Day, i.e. Sunday. Christie writes, at once he knew that this was to be the great day of his life. The spirit rushed into him. He took up his pen and wrote, I'd love it if you, Sarah, could tell us what John writes here, according to Christie, because I think she does something really interesting with the way that she quotes from the book of Revelation here.
Yeah, so the story ends not with Agatha's words, but with Revelation's words. And that means that this is what closes out the entire book, Star Over Bethlehem. In a way, as Mary exits, so does Agatha, and she cedes her voice over. And so what we have first is John. The first lines are John's own lines in the book of Revelation, where he says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and behind me, I heard a great voice as of a trumpet. And that's interesting because that first part, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, is from chapter 21, nearly the end of Revelation. And then the second phrase, and behind me, I heard a great voice as of a trumpet, that's from chapter one. So she's interestingly, what we can see, she is very deliberately selecting what she wants to leave us with. So this is not just, this last paragraph is not a straight quote out of Revelation, but her own unique patchwork.
She's magpieing the book of Revelation, that tricky Christine Halloween.
There you go. And then the great voice as of a trumpet is the voice of Jesus. So Jesus in Revelation, has the last words in the story and this book. And I'll read them in succession. But again, she goes back and forth. She quotes first from Revelation 22, then from Revelation 1, and then she goes back to Revelation 22. So once again, deliberately stitching together verses from the end and the beginning. So here's the way the whole collection ends in Jesus' voice. I am Alpha and Omega, the first and the last. I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. Amen. And have the keys of hell and of death. Behold, I come quickly, and my reward is with me to give every man according as his work shall be. And it's so striking to me that for this book of pious stories, even the ones that are not so strictly biblical, have deep, deep religious themes to them, how she ends here with letting Jesus have the last word. And also really, it's really a proclamation of his power and his glory, and that it's up to him to wrap things up and make things right.
Yeah, I found it really fascinating because this ending, these passages here that she's stitching together from the book of Revelation, they provided for me the second and much more robust connection to the rest of Christie's oeuvre, because I could not help remarking on that phrase, a new heaven and earth, a new heaven and a new earth. That is a phrase that Christie uses time and again in her political thrillers, especially, or her mysteries that have elements of political thrillerdom in them, such as One, Two, Buckle My Shoe. She uses them, I find, and I'm painting this now with a very broad brush, but I don't think it's inaccurate to say that she tends to use that phrase when she's referencing irresponsible, youth-driven revolutionary movements that are looking to dismantle the current system, dismantle the status quo, and replace it with what? That is precisely the question for Christie, because she's always saying, well, what are you going to do? You know, if you're braying for a new heaven and earth, you need to tell me what this new system is going to be. And you can tell that Agatha Christie was personally never convinced that anyone in her day and age, any of her peers in this modern age, had the wherewithal to tear down the status quo and replace it with something adequate, something that was not going to do more harm than it was intended to do. And I think that we can get an interesting insight here into why. My reading of the way that she quotes the book of Revelation here at the very end of Star Over Bethlehem and Other Stories is that she does buy into the notion of a new heaven and a new earth if it's Jesus who is the one who is calling the shots, because he has divine right. He is the Son of God Almighty, as you said, and he has the ability to make systemic change. I mean, that is something that she clearly deeply believes. She buys into the idea of Jesus as a disruptor, but no one else. And it's almost like for her, and again, this is totally my interpretation here, but it feels like for her, the bar is that high. It's like, are you Jesus? No? Then shut up. Then just go to the back of the line, buddy, and get a job. And again, I'm not being totally fair to her here, but I just get that sense that, you know, no one in this, in the political sphere, no regular human, no matter how well-meaning he or she might be, had that right, that divine right that Jesus did, because he was working in the service of God. And really, I'm not saying I agree with that, but that might be the best defense I've ever come across or been able to cobble together myself of Christie's conservatism. And that would be both small c and large c political conservatism, which we really do come across so consistently in her thrillers. And I have bemoaned before on this podcast the fact that it never changes. And I've said, wow, you know, you'd think, you know, you'd see like some sort of an evolution or at least some kind of a change in her political thinking over time. But like, it's really there. It's like right there in the beginning and in some of those thrillers in the 20s on through Passenger to Frankfurt, you know, like at the very end of her life. But you know what? If it's at least in some way tied to her feelings as a Christian, I get the solidity and the static nature of her stance. And I don't think it's that simple, but this really did, you know, when I was sitting back and I finished the story and I was thinking about it after I remarked on that phrase, it made me think about that stance in her political thrillers and just her overall political stance in a different way. And that's something that I really appreciated, because I still grapple with that as a lover of Christie.
Yeah, I think you've read her exactly right. And I think to look at certain species of political conservatism apart from the window she's given us here into her religious beliefs really gives you a misleading impression, because you could think then that she's, you know, purely an ally of the elite. Like, people insist on remembering her as writing about rich people and country manners and not seeing all of the middle class, working class, poor people that appear in her stories as well. And I think they're really specific issue she takes, and I think this is very much tied to the history of the 20th century that she lived through, is the promise of a new heaven and a new earth with a remade human nature. And if the question she's addressing is at that level and not on whether or not there should be this particular policy change or extension of rights or change of tax code, whatever, but actually, can anyone promise a new heaven and an earth now? And can anyone actually remake human nature now? No. Like, all of her human dramas in the mystery stories are built on the fact that human nature behaves very consistently and very unbeautifully much of the time. And we do a lot to cover up to show that we're not nearly as bad as we want people to think. But in fact, that's the terrible truth about us. And these things have to be managed. But the human nature is not going to be remade. And anyone who thinks they can remake government to give us a heavenly kingdom, heaven help them. So I think you're absolutely, like, especially, I was thinking of Passenger to Frankfurt. Oh, and I have to tell you, Kemper, I was just on a trip. I was in Switzerland. I was waiting for my flight. And I kid you not, I heard an announcement in English over the loudspeaker paging Passenger to Frankfurt. I don't know what the name was. But I was just like, I'm in an airport and I heard it. I heard the phrase Passenger to Frankfurt. I was so excited.
I thought you were about to say paging Passenger to Frankfurt, Sir Stafford Die.
No, not quite that. Not quite that amazing. I probably would have fainted and then I'd probably have been chloroformed and kidnapped. So just as well.
That's pretty great.
But anyway, but Passenger to Frankfurt is so lunatic, but I kind of love it in a way, because she's just spelling out to the far extreme of the possibilities of having a new heaven and an earth with this terrifying charismatic figure, but the only way you can get new human nature is basically drugging everybody into being benevolent. I mean, for her, that's really it. Either you do that, which is a horrifying dystopian totalitarian nightmare, or someday, who knows when, in a way that nobody control, you know, God through Jesus Christ makes things right again with the kind of power that only God can ever have. So I think you've exactly clued into where her concerns are and where her religious faith plays into these political questions, but I think it's really at this very high level, far more than it's at any particular policy level.
No, absolutely. I mean, hey, this is someone who in her old age, you know, voted to keep England in the European Economic Community, right? Like, basically the proto-European Union. Like, she, she could make, I think, some interesting policy decisions, but it feels like a leap. But when you think it through, it makes perfect sense that this cynicism run amok, which is what I think you get in Passenger to Frankfurt with Benvo. And you're just like, oh my God, like if you, you know, if this is really, and it is run amok in that book, but this is what we talked about in, when you came on in the last episode, you know, this notion of low anthropology, and it really does make, especially Miss Marple so powerful. And it's part of why I think Miss Marple is such an excellent character, because it feels true. Her cynicism and her low opinion of her fellow mortals feels true, but at the center of that is a deep and abiding faith. And you can say that about Miss Marple. And interestingly, I think after reading this story, like, you of course could have always said that about Agatha Christie, because we sort of know, right, that she was a devout Christian. Like you said, it's just something that we know. But I think you can see the evidence here, and you can see how that religious faith interacts with the high flown political beliefs, this overarching political philosophy that she airs once or twice every decade, like over the course of her 20th century career, and which of course is also so affected by the horrors that she, you know, this is someone who lived through two world wars as a fully grown adult who knew, you know, didn't miss a thing. So she knew everything. I mean, I can't even imagine like still having any faith in anything after that, probably, you know? So it's just really interesting to see that connection. It's much more direct, I think, when you get to the end of the story than it is in anything else. And it gives a really great insight into her.
Yeah. And I think that finally brings us back to the subtle polemic of regarding Mary as Queen of Heaven in the story, because on the surface, you can argue she is defending the idea of Mary as queen of Heaven and as being, you know, assumed directly into heaven rather than dying. The thing is, most of the artwork and the presentation of Mary in these kind of, you know, religious aesthetic context, Mary stays young forever. She's always the young mother. So she's very beautiful. She is unblemished, and she does not have a worn and ravaged face. And of course, the whole purpose of doing that is to venerate her, glorify her. You can see like really outrageous Baroque depictions of Mary as Queen of Heaven. So what's so interesting to me is that she is affirming what would have been fairly edgy doctrinal assertions for her Church of England context, but at the same time, also completely turning them on their head by consistently depicting Mary as humble, not particularly wise, not particularly insightful, not remarkable. You know, she's good at making dinner and washing up the dishes and sticking to this young man in promise to her son who has left the scene. And that is what, to Agatha, that is what is glorious. And that is what is worthy of honor. And yet even that Mary would have been as uncomfortable as Agatha herself with being adored and venerated. So in a sense, she gets the respect and honor she deserves, and yet she herself would continually reject it and just be deeply embarrassed by it. So I think, again, it's just amazing how in such a short story, I mean, I can't believe we've been talking almost 2 hours about such a short story, but there's so much packed in here that she can both affirm and subvert this edgy doctrine at the exact same time in a way that captures everything she thinks about spirituality and domesticity and women's roles and men's roles, and can do it in the end without even undercutting John's way and John's spirituality. I mean, he has the last word. It's like, it's purely non-competitive. Mary goes off with her son just as she wants. John gets his vision just as he wants. They both have their way. They're both valid. And you just had like the same deep faith convictions and moral and virtue convictions, and at the same time, a total reconfiguring of all these pieces. Like, how does she do that? I'm just kind of in awe.
That's such a good point. Yeah, she's affirming and subverting simultaneously, basically. It's hard because I would never tell anyone who hasn't read a lot of Christie to read The Island by Agatha Christie Mallowan as a story that's
don't start
representative.
There.
Yeah, don't start there. But for someone who is steeped in Christie, certainly, and even like, you know, if they've read more than half, say, of her standard canon of the 66 mystery novels, and they're saying, I want to get a sense of who was this woman? Like, I just kind of want to like take a peek into, you know, what kind of a person she was. I'd be like, The Island's not a bad place that, you know, to start or maybe end, but like it would be, I think, certainly a worthwhile stop along that journey, because I think it really is giving so much insight into her as a person, but also, like you said, what she is capable of doing as a writer. Like that nimble, deft touch that she has, where she's able to do so many different things at once within a couple of pages and never breaking a sweat. You know, like you never feel like there's all that much going on in the story, because there's really not. You could also finish the story and be like, cute, great. You read it in a very surface way and like, that's fine. But you could also choose to talk about it for 2 hours on a podcast episode, say. We should end now because we probably could be here for another 3 hours. But it really is amazing to me that, you know, the story is as rich as it is.
Yeah, agreed. Phenomenal. Miraculous.
Miraculous. Perfect place to end with The Island by Agatha Christie Mallon. Well, Sarah Hindlicky Wilson, you had great expectations to rise to, given how wonderful our last episode was. But you certainly rose to them. I think you exceeded them, actually, because there is just so much to chew over on this episode. And I cannot express how thrilled I am to have you on again. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. And, you know, I never would have dug this deep if I hadn't had an excuse to come on here and talk to you about it. So thank you again for the invitation.
Thank you again to Sarah Hindlicky Wilson. I have included a link to that article that she wrote, Agatha Christie, A Very Elusive Christian. I've also thrown on a link to Sarah's general website so that you can check out her various projects that she has going on. Always up to something interesting, that's Sarah Hindlicky Wilson. For next week's episode, I am going to be focusing on the adaptations of Agatha Christie, both on the small and large screen. I am going to be speaking with Teresa Peskel, who wrote a wonderful book that some of you might be aware of. It is called Agatha Christie, She Watched. That would be Agatha Christie, comma, She Watched. Already loving this book. And the subtitle here is even better. One woman's plot to watch 201 Agatha Christie movies without murdering the director, screenwriter, cast, or her husband. Teresa Peskel is an avid Agatha Christie fan, and together with her husband, Bill Peskel, they are doing some really interesting things with Agatha Christie. We will get into it when we have our conversation about Agatha Christie adaptations. And just so you know, I have structured our conversation with a little bit of a ranking project. That is always my go-to framework for a conversation whenever I can possibly do it. Teresa and I are going to be talking about our best and worst adaptations when it comes to various iterations of Agatha Christie films and TV programs down the ages. So basically that means we are going to be doing the best and worst episode. So two episodes each for the following: the Margaret Rutherford Miss Marple films, the Peter Ustinov Poirot films, the Joan Hickson Miss Marple television episodes, the David Suchet Poirot television episodes, and then all those Miss Marple episodes in which Geraldine McEwan appears, and also all those episodes in which Julia McKenzie appears. So that is six different iterations of Marple and Poirot adaptations, which means we will be discussing 12 episodes each. I'm not going to say that we will be discussing 24 episodes, because perhaps we will have some overlap as to our best and worst for each of these programs. But maybe not. Maybe we will have no overlap whatsoever and we will be discussing 24 different episodes. But I expect this to be a spirited and wide-ranging conversation with a fellow Christie fanatic. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So that will be my next episode. And in the meantime, you can, of course, check out the podcast's Patreon page. I've included a link in the notes to this episode. For March, I am covering an old television episode from the 70s in the UK. It's from the Crown Court program, and the episode is called Evil Liver. It was written by Niall Marsh, and it stars Joan Hickson. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the Crown Court program, which included me until a few weeks ago, it involved the unspooling of a fictional court case over a couple of episodes, at the end of which a real-life jury would deliberate and decide whether the defendant in question was guilty or not guilty. Like, real people would decide this. It's going to be a lot of fun. So that's what's happening over on Patreon. You can, of course, find the podcast on Twitter at All About the Dame and on Instagram at All About Agatha. And you can find me on Facebook at Kemper Donovan Books. And if you haven't yet gone out and bought The Busybody, my debut mystery novel, I would so very appreciate it if you took a look. A great deal of you have been so supportive and have sent me such nice comments about how much you enjoyed the book. And I know there are more of you out there who could get a few hours of enjoyment out of my homage to Agatha Christie in the form of a contemporary puzzle mystery. You can click on the links that I've provided in the notes to purchase the book. And as I mentioned up top, I do have a second leg of my book tour coming up on the East Coast and in the Midwest. So click on the link I've provided in the notes to check out my tour dates and locations on my website. And if you haven't yet done so, please do take a moment to give a rating and or a review to the podcast. That would be lovely. And I will see you next time. Bye.